From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack.
And I'm Evan Dawson. We start our weekly review with a rather extraordinary moment on the show this week. We were discussing a local murder case, the shooting death of a young mother named Megan Dix. She was found dead on August 25th in Brockport. The woman accused of killing her is 31-year-old Holly Colino, a former East Rochester student who had been living in Arizona. Colino appears to have suffered from some kind of mental illness for a long time. Now, during our conversation, Colino's brother Jason called the show. He wanted to share his experience in trying to help his sister and ultimately giving up on intervening. Let's listen.
You know, I received a Facebook message from a police officer from East Rochester about the spray paint. And I thought she was in Arizona at the time, so I kind of played it off as she has a hard time maintaining relationships with people, so I would assume that she may have gotten into an argument with somebody and somebody went out and spray painted her name all over buildings. Because usually, you know, if you're going to spray paint your name on a building, you wouldn't actually use your real name. So I thought she was in Arizona at the time. Then I got a phone call later that day or that night from the investigators saying at the barbecue place, she pulled a gun on somebody and they had helicopters looking for her. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, that's crazy stuff right there. And then on the next day, I seen the article about the suspect in custody in Brockport. Now, you know, my heart kind of sank. I was like, oh my God, I had a feeling that that was Holly they were talking about. So it was very surreal that it escalated like that.
If I would have told you, say in July, that this was coming, that this kind of allegation against Holly was coming, I think it would shock anybody, but shock and surprise are different things. Would it have surprised you?
No. You know, like, deep down, I know she has problems, and I got a text message from her about 6 months ago, and she was saying some really harsh things, and I know she's had a lot of issues and the way she handles things, and, you know, deep down, I'm a little scared to even be around her, and I really didn't, you know, feel comfortable having her around my family and stuff, and just the way she would have these outbursts, and she would get so angry, and it just wasn't rational thinking. And I calmed down. I was like, hey, you know, maybe you should apologize to me. And then she went even harder on me, and I had to block her. This was 6 months ago. But, you know, I even told the police officer when I found out she had two guns, I'm like, oh, my gosh. You know, I had a really bad feeling. And I'm like, I'm glad you guys found her, but that was before they connected her to that other crime in the area, so I guess it was too late at that point.
Talking to Holly Colino's brother, Jason, and so you had to block your sister. You were concerned about not only her anger and aggression, but, you know, what she might do. Did you or anybody else around her try to, and again, I don't know, I'm not an expert, and I'm sure you wouldn't call yourself an expert on how to do this, but did you try to intervene in any way at any point, whether it was in the last 6 months or in previous years on this?
Well, about 10 years ago, I received a phone call from Human Resources at my old job, and the Human Resource lady said she got the sheriffs on the phone, and they need you to go pick your sister up. I'm like, what's going on? She goes, well, she was driving through people's front lawns in Harrington or Penfield, and she said she was praying. I'm like, what are you talking about? But that's literally as crazy as it sounds. That's exactly what's happened. So the police officer came to my house, and, you know, he dropped my sister off, and I go, well, wait a second. Don't you think we should maybe, you know, have her looked at or get her checked out? Like, he's like, no, I have to release her into your custody. She's not a threat to anybody else. You know, we don't appear that she is. So we have to release her into a family member's custody or we have to hold her. And that's what he told me. So that's kind of my understanding of it. And, you know, the police weren't really willing to do anything at all. And I had several girlfriends and I've dated throughout the last, you know, 10 years. And we've all sat down with her and we've tried to talk with her. And I was like, hey, you know, when I was 12 years old, I went to talk to a counselor and I tried to bring that up to her and say, it's okay if you need somebody to talk to. I really think you could benefit from it. It's not a bad thing. People do it all the time. It's normal. You know, I'll support you in it. And she just wouldn't hear it. And anytime I'd bring it up to her, she would kind of turn around on, you know, saying I had something wrong with me or my girlfriend might have had something wrong with me and there was nothing wrong with her. And she didn't want to hear it at all. She just kind of shut it down and it would actually alienate, she would try to alienate herself even further away.
Next up, author Kurt Anderson has written a new book called Fantasyland. It's a 500-year history of how he says America went haywire. Haywire in the sense of Americans not using solid reasoning and believing things that aren't true. Now, why is this? Anderson says it's because we're Americans and, quote, because being American means we can believe anything we want, that our beliefs are equal or superior to anyone else's, experts be damned, end quote. We invited Anderson on the show, and we heard from a caller named Jim. He's a conspiracy theorist who says he researched JFK's assassination and the 9/11 attacks. He strongly disagrees with Anderson, and he says he was offended by Kurt Anderson's arguments. You'll hear Jim's call, and then Kurt Anderson's response.
In the late 90s, I started researching the JFK assassination, completely unbiased. My father's a Vietnam veteran. And I just wanted to see if I could find answers and understand the thing better myself. Well, what I came to be surprised by was how much can be learned when you study something. And your presupposition that people that believe these things somehow can't process facts in reality is so insulting to people like me that spent so long and so much of themselves invested in facts and in evidence. And letting those things lead the way before we decide what's what. I would challenge you to a debate on JFK's assassination, on any assassination in the 60s, on 9/11, on anything you want to point to and again, presuppose that it's just not possible and people that believe these things are believing in fantasies and cherry-pick facts, man, and the opposite is true. There's a reason 3,000 architects and engineers, actual 3,000 architects and engineers, have a website and are signed up and risk their lives and their reputations devoted to exposing facts in reality. And if you don't know who David Ray Griffin is and Bob McElveen, you are on the ass end of development.
All right, Jim, progress. Jim, stay there. Stay there. There's a lot there.
All right.
Stay there, Jim. I'm put back on hold. Go ahead, Kurt.
Jim and I obviously disagree, certainly about, as he is, suggesting that 9/11 is some kind of inside job that we don't know the truth about. I have read and studied a lot about the 9/11 attacks, and I most certainly don't believe that that's a correct understanding of what happened there. I have read lots of books on all sides about the Kennedy assassination, and while definitely there was a lot of bumbling and garbling in the initial investigation of that assassination, I have not been persuaded that there's some larger conspiracy involving pick your co-conspirator in that. And in the book, I talk about conspiracism at much greater length than I do in the excerpt that you looked at on Facebook. But no doubt there are definitely conspiracies exist. There have been big, long, consequential conspiracies in America. Most of them are exposed and discovered in fairly short order, not always. But I'm not saying they don't exist. And I'm not saying that the establishment mainstream media always is right about everything, always. But I do think that many people, and maybe you're one of them, I don't know, are over inclined and over invested in believing that whatever the nominal agreed upon expert belief about how 9/11 happened or how President Kennedy was assassinated is untrue. And you know the better truth because of these other facts you've collected or allegations or whatever, I think there's a predisposition there. And I think that's, I'm not saying it's the same as people who believe in supernatural things. I'm saying it's a different flavor of the same kind of American conviction and passion.
Have you ever rewatched a favorite film from your childhood and now, as an adult, see it in a different light? We talked about movies that are offensive, racist, or just don't hold up today like they did when they were made. Films like Breakfast at Tiffany's, from Mickey Rooney's racist portrayal of Mr. Yuniyoshi, or a number of Disney films. Films like Peter Pan, which called Native Americans red men. At the center of our discussion was Blazing Saddles, which uses satire to make a point about white flight and racism. In one of the early scenes, a group of white cowboys stereotypes African Americans working on a railroad. In this clip, the film's director, Mel Brooks, tries to flip that on its head. You'll hear that scene, and then the perception of our panelists. First, you'll hear longtime film critic Jack Garner, and then you'll hear local actor Jonathan Nketha, who speaks about what the film says about the black experience.
Now, come on, boys. Where's your spirit? I don't hear no singing. When you were slaves, you sang like birds. Come on, how about a good old work song.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a belt out of you? Some get a kick from cocaine.
Hold it, hold it! What the hell is that? I'm in a song. A real song. Something like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
Swing low, chariot.
Don't know that one, huh?
So who's the hero of that scene?
Well, this, if anybody has a right to complain, it's the rednecks. This is a redneck organization should complain about being racially stereotyped in that one. Yeah, I'm being a little facetious here, but they're the ones who come off. You know, he comes off as the idiot in this thing, and I think the film's a wonderful parody, and we got to differentiate between parody that has a point that is basically positive, as opposed to parody that is a point that is racist.
Yeah, there's nothing I can look at Peter Pan and some of those songs, just overtly racist stereotypes, right. No value. I am not a scholar on Blazing Saddles. I'm listening to people who know a lot more than I am. And Jack, what you're saying is this was part of the point was to pillory these racial stereotypes,
right,
or racial fragility?
I think so. I'd like to think so. Mel Brooks is a smart fella, and I think I would hope that's what it is. That's the way I take it. So, that's why I'm comfortable with that movie.
Okay.
Jonathan, are you comfortable? You're shaking your
head. Well, yeah, I mean, I got flashbacks to being in college and at parties, people asking me for weed, if I can help them score some weed. I mean, it's the same thing. Like I said before, people have a box. They want to put you in that box, and that's where it is. And if you can't look at something like this and see the absurdity of it and find, again, the opportunity for dignity through a character, that part there is the essence, I think, of the Black experience in America, where, you know what? You have to maintain a level of dignity. You could go out and, you know, say something, give the people peace of your mind, start cursing them out, whatever, go back and forth, or just sort of like, I don't know that song. I don't know what you're talking about. It's just unfortunate that it was said in 74. I dealt with it in the late 90s, and I'm sure someone right now is dealing with it today.
But aren't they showing this particular group of African Americans in a positive intellectual light by singing a beautifully harmonized Cole Porter song?
Well, absolutely. I think we're looking at this, and when someone else just watches it, hey, let's watch this movie on Saturday morning when we're hungover, and they're laughing at it, what are they getting out of it? Are they being educated about it? Are they understanding what satire actually is? Are they understanding how far Mel Brooks chose to go with his comedy instead of having some more subtle things or more slapstick to then get to, like, again, going transitioning to the 80s with that type of comedy and film?
You bring up a really great point, I think, and that is what people bring into a movie. I remember once seeing The Wild Bunch, nothing to do with this topic today, but The Wild Bunch, and I thought it was a film about the horrificness of violence. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple scenes in there where I'm going, oh my Lord, and I'm just so shaken. And meanwhile, in front of me, a woman stands up and yells, "Get him!" It's what you bring into a film, that causes that.
Finally, Fashion Week of Rochester is coming in October. Here's one thing you probably won't see: super thin runway models, as in models who appear to be dangerously thin. That's obviously an industry trend, but here's Rochester Fashion Week director Megan Mundy explaining why that won't be the case here.
One of my most important things about Fashion Week was we are the inclusive Fashion Week, not the exclusive Fashion Week. So we use all shapes and sizes. And the philosophy that I had for this was, if you're sitting in the audience and watching a runway show, you want to look up as a normal size human being and say to yourself, I can wear that. I don't have to be real thin. We do casting calls in the community. We use real people, all sizes, and we celebrate healthy, well-adjusted people that, want to just model and give their time. So we are a huge supporter of people not being real thin. And at one point I had someone tell me that I should fly in models from Toronto and New York. And it's not our philosophy. Our philosophy is to celebrate all shapes and sizes and make everybody feel good.
Fashion Week is aiming to raise $500,000 for the Center for Youth and the Crisis Nursery. The Crisis Nursery helps mothers like Sarah Wittberg, who nearly died from a seizure. She had a 2-year-old daughter, and the Crisis Nursery stepped in to care for her daughter while doctors tended to Sarah. Here's that remarkable story.
They have a special fancy doctor named Status Epilepticus. It sounds funnier than it is, but what it is, what it means is that you just keep cycling into a state
can't
of seizure.
Get out of it,
you
yeah.
can't get out of it. You can't get out of it. And it was at that point, after I think about 15, 16 hours, I don't even know. The story was told
you're
to
you're
me.
Out again. Like, yeah,
I'm out.
Yeah.
There was one moment that I did have an out-of-body experience. I saw myself on a table with my arms and legs strapped. I saw myself without clothes on, and I saw myself biting my father. That was the only moment from the seizure that I remember. I remember my best friend calling me when I woke up, screaming, oh my God, I thought I was driving here to help you die. She thought she was coming home to help me die. My parents were faced with that decision as well. A possible death would be on their hand.
Because at a certain point of the cycle, the doctors are telling your family, we don't know if we can stop it. We don't
yes.
know if she's going to live.
Yes. I think it was just a mixture of everything inside of me and everything outside of me that brought me out of the seizure. Maybe it was my daughter. Maybe somewhere back in the head, something yeah. said, wake up, Sarah, wake up. And I did. I did not let her come to the hospital because it was very scary. When I woke up, I couldn't say my name. I couldn't walk. I couldn't talk. But I knew my daughter had to be taken care of because all of my people were taking care of me. And that's when Faith came by from the Crisis Nursery. I remember her because of the way that she walks. And I remember that I walk like that sometimes too. And for some reason, that was just the connection that I made immediately. And I immediately loved her because she was same, if that makes sense.
Sure. Something familiar.
I didn't know anything else, but she held my hand, a stranger. She held my hand and she said, we're going to take care of your daughter so that your parents can take care of you. Something bad happened to you. There's legal procedures that I had to do that I couldn't do. And she helped me. Can you sign this piece of paper? No, I couldn't. Can you nod your head? Yes. Yes, I can. And from that moment on, the Crisis Nursery was a communication hub for my parents. I believe so, right, Elaine? Like, what happened to me at that point? Please fill in those
so,
blanks
you know,
for me.
I remember this, obviously, and we have to have parents because it's voluntary. Everything that happens at the center, even our homeless, are voluntary. So we had to have a voluntary admission. We knew we wanted to help, but we had to have someone say yes. And because she was awake, even though she was not completely alert, she was the only one who could give us consent. Mm-hmm. So Faith shows up. And meanwhile, I want to change my name to Faith. I mean, is that the best name ever?
I actually didn't know if she was talking about a person or something.
No, she's a person.
Faith.
She's a person.
Faith,
and then Faith, yeah. And she really is an angel. So she shows up and she stands there holding her hand saying, don't worry about anything. We're taking care of Pearl, but we have to give consent. All Sarah could do was blink her eyes like that. She couldn't speak. She couldn't walk. She couldn't sign. And we took over from there. And then we coordinated all of her care. And she was with us as long as she was with us.
And that does it for another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon, Monday to Friday, noon to 2 on AM 1370. Let's see here. WRUR, right? 88.5 FM. And on WEOS, 89.5 FM all throughout the Finger Lakes. That's Finger Lakes Public Radio.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.